Thank you, Boris. The next speaker today is Lois Keedon, and she's a director of the Live Art Development Agency, which is it offers resources, professional development initiatives, and projects for the support of live art practices and critical discourses in the UK. She's also has a lot of experience in and many years of organising live art events, and she's going to talk to us about her projects.
Thank you very much. Thank you to European Live Art Archive for inviting me to be here. The horror of following Boris Nisloni. So it's very different. I'm going to sort of partly talk from a paper and partly improvise a little bit as I go along. I'm going to speak in English. I'm really sorry. I'm going to try and speak slowly. I usually speak too quickly for most English people to understand. So if I'm talking too quickly, then just shout or throw things. So I'm going to do a talk called Memories Are Made of This. It's the song. I hope you'll realize it's the cheesy song. Put the microphone on. Is that better? No. Testing 1, 2, 3, testing. Now it's on, yeah? Cool. I think it was on, actually. Yeah, it was, yeah. Cool. Okay. Is that better? Okay. Many apologies, I'm going to speak in English, and I say if I speak too quickly, then please tell me to shut up. So I'm going to give a little talk sort of in two parts. One is, the first part is just some general thoughts about sort of issues of archives and archiving. And the second part is about some of the projects that the agency, Live Art Development Agency, is working on related to archiving. This first part is sort of partly from an essay I wrote for a project from 2009 called Notes on a Return, which was an amazing project that took place in Newcastle in England, looking at some performance work that had happened in Newcastle in the 1980s in a museum there, and then had been completely removed from the memories and the archives of the museum, and it was a project to reinstate that work. So this is just some general thoughts about archives and archiving. So interest in the histories of performance and the archiving of its documents and traces is reaching fever pitch in the UK. In recent years, there have been a host of exhibitions concerned with performance documents and documentation, including in Tate Liverpool, a project called Art, Lives and Videotape, Manuel Vaison's Encounters project, the John Hansard Gallery's Live Art on Camera, Performance and Photography. And complementing these exhibition projects, there are initiatives like Paul Clark's Performing the Archive, The Future of the Past, Heike Rom's What's Welsh for Performance Art, the Live Art Archive, National Review of Live Art, Video Archive, which Nikki Milliken will be talking about, Oriana Fox's Once More with Feeling, and Sophia Yadunghao's Notes on a Return, from which these notes have written for. These are just a handful of the recent research projects which are looking at performance and its archiving from a scholarly perspective, a historical perspective, and an artistic creative perspective. And there are many, many reasons for this heightened level of interest in performance documentation and the archive. I guess because we can is the most obvious. Technology has made so much possible in ways that were previously inconceivable. It could be argued that technology is the largest contributory factor to not only the possibilities of archiving performance, but also to the explosion of interest in live art itself. But that's a whole different symposium. The huge advances in camera technologies means that anyone and everyone can document performance. I guess most people in this room could document this now on their smartphones. More significantly, technology means we can all access online platforms to research, connect, catalogue, archive, publish and disseminate, as we've just seen just from the presentations this morning. And against this background of technology, there is a sort of a generation of senior artists that this European Live Art archive project is beginning with artists who have this huge body of work behind them, supported by a massive amount of documentation, and who want to look at and mark their place within certain kinds of cultural histories and certain kinds of cultural contexts. And in front of those senior artists, there is a new, younger generation of artists who are not only aware of, but increasingly increasingly interested and engaged with the achievements of the artists who've gone before them. They recognize they're standing on the shoulders of giants. And watching these older artists and these younger artists is a relatively new breed of scholars, writers, curators, who are all interested in trying to create sort of informed critical and cultural contexts and historical lineages around these itinerant and interdisciplinary practices. And surrounding all this are the expanding visions of all kinds of different cultural institutions, museums, libraries, theatres, galleries, festivals, academies, funding bodies, who are all looking to try and locate and accommodate these new forms of late 20th and early 21st century artistic practices. So the conditions are really sort of dynamic and auspicious time to consider the nature and the cultural value of performance and its unfolding relationship to institutions, histories, and archives. But I think it's also really important that we must be alert to the dangers of privileging a looking back at the expense of a looking forward, and to ensure that there's an equal investment in the practice of future generations as there is in the archiving of the past. Certainly in the UK, there's been a lot of money thrown at archival projects, a lot more money thrown at the past than is being thrown at younger artists who are the future. And I think it's really important that we sort of strike that balance. But what's also clear from the amazing range of archival projects in the UK is that this looking back is not just about what's been before, but it's actually about what is now and what might yet be. And that the process of archiving is itself a strategy about thinking about what performance is, what performance can be, and inevitably sort of where it belongs. As Boris just said, the difference between having an archive and being an archive seems critical. And what many of the projects in the UK also reflect is that the histories of performance are both recorded and recalled in equal measure. That the documents of performance, its photographs, its videos, its writings, its drawings, its everything, are only part of the story, and that the recollections, the memories of the experience or the event of performance are just as important and just as influential. And that the practices and ideas of artists live on in really meaningful and influential ways through other people as much as through records. And the histories of performance are folk histories as much as art historical ones. And that the archiving of performance is as much about people as it is about things. But of course, both documents and memories are equally unreliable. Photographs or film can never give a true account of a live work, and memory is incredibly subjective and selective. And a history of performance can rest uneasily somewhere between the two. And this, of course, is the challenge of the performance archive and the challenge to the performance archivist. So I'm now going to talk a little bit about some of the agency's work. We, as Denise said, we're the Live Art Development Agency. We're based in London. To give you a little bit of context about our work, we were set up in 1999 to try to support the development of live art artists, audiences, contexts, discourses in the UK and internationally. And we have an open access research library. It's not as big as Boris's. We run Unbound, which is an online shop for live art books, DVDs, and editions. We try and test models of artistic professional development, different kinds of dialogue, different kinds of debate. We try to contribute to research culture, to knowledge transfer and pedagogy. This is a project we're involved in with two universities in London, looking at the cultural value of performance. And we try to develop new ways of increasing access to and engagement with live art through programming initiatives. This is a big project we did at Tate Modern, a project we did in 2006 around performance and human rights, and through publishing projects and initiatives. Those are just three examples of the kinds of things we publish. And all of our work is grounded in a real commitment to trying to create the conditions in which innovation, experimentation, and risk can thrive. and to try and develop new forms of public engagement around the nature, role and value of culture. We've always been engaged with questions of documentation, histories and archives, but at the same time recognising many of the problems inherent in those issues. What can and should be archived, where and how should they be archived, and what is the cultural status and value of those kinds of things. So the three things I want to talk about is firstly that our study room, it's our core resource. It's a free open access research facility. It's used by artists, students, curators, academics. And it's used for either very general or very specific or very practical or very theoretical research. We think it's one of the largest publicly accessible archives of or libraries of live art related videos in the UK. And for many of the younger artists and students who come to us, it's the only opportunity that they have to begin to access performances that it was impossible for them to experience live. So we have about 2,000 publications, which range from big academic texts through to books on sort of individual artist monographs. We have about 2,500 DVDs, videos of performance documents and documentation. We also are kind of cataloguing and archiving articles and essays, things that otherwise people, things maybe interesting articles about performance that are sort of buried in a journal that otherwise students might not come across. And we also try and catalogue a huge range of magazines and journals, particularly back issues of journals and magazines that don't exist anymore, like Performance Research, High Performance Magazine, things like that. And we now, in our study room, we now house the Library of Performing Rights, which is a resource of about 300 books, DVDs and articles, which has been sort of gathered by artists and activists and academics from around the world, looking at the intersection between performance and human rights that we developed in 2006 for the Performance Studies International Conference I talked about a minute ago. And that's now a sort of autonomous library in its own right that lives with us but also sort of goes out on the road on tour, and we hope to be touring it to South America next year. We don't talk about the study room as an archive. A lot of people phone and say, can we come and visit your archive? And we say, we don't have one. We have a study room. It's more of a collection, it's a partial history, but it's a history nonetheless. We didn't even think about, when we set up the agency in 1999, we didn't even think about setting up a study room or an archive. But we'd been running the performance program at the Institute of Contemporary Arts in London, and we'd been documenting all of the work we did there because we could, because the technology existed. But also we wanted that work to be seen on a sort of equal status as the visual arts, as the exhibitions. We wanted it to have a trace, to have something, a document that was as valid as the catalogues that were being produced for the exhibition programme. So we were documenting everything, and when we set up the agency, we brought copies of all of that material with us, really because we didn't trust the ICA to look after it. We brought it to safekeep to look after it. And the first day we set up the agency, people started phoning and said, can I come in and see this video? And we were like, yeah, sure, of course you can. And the study room has really grown from that, and now it's the sort of epicenter, the sort of heart and soul of what we do. But the materials in the study room, as I say, are not an archive. They're more a sort of reflection of our work. So it's partly all of this stuff we bought from the ICA, but also a reflection of the sort of the some of the projects we've done, some of the sort of research we've undertaken. So we have we've done a lot of work with Chinese performance art over the last 10 or so years. And because of that, we have this huge archive of Chinese performance. But we haven't done any work with Zimbabwe, so we don't have any documentation of Zimbabwean performance art. We've done a lot of work around identity politics, so we have a huge range of materials around sort of queer culture, black culture, women's performance. So it's a sort of reflection of our interests, but it's also a reflection of our sort of networks and our sort of contacts. And it's also a reflection of our approach to ideas of research, which is very much sort of practice-based as much as sort of scholarly research. So as many sort of theoretical texts we have in the study room, we also have an equal amount of sort of artist books, artist's own publications, artist's own materials. So in some sense, the study room is a sort of archive of the agency. It wasn't, although it wasn't set up to be that, it is a kind of archive of the agency. And the materials we have in there, as I say, are sort of partly a reflection of the work we do, but we also, it's a constant process of sort of research and acquisition. So we, everybody who uses the study room, and it's used by hundreds of people, we ask them what they were interested in. We ask them what we didn't have, what kind of things we should be getting. We keep our eye out all of the time for new publications, whether it's sort of published books by big publishing houses or little things produced by artists. And so we're constantly constantly shopping. We're constantly acquiring materials for the study room, and just making sure that what we're doing sort of reflects and is meeting the sort of interests and aspirations of the people who use it. What we've also done with the study room is we've commissioned a range of artists to write personal guides to the materials in the study room to really help people use it in different ways. The original idea was to really to help people who were using the study room to sort of experience materials in a new way and point out things that they may not otherwise have sort of come across. Some people who come, they know exactly what they're researching. Other people arrive and say, I'm interested in the body and performance. What should I be looking at? And we found we were always pointing people in the same directions. And we thought it'd be much more interesting to get the artist Franco B to point people in different directions. So we invited Franco to write a study room guide to point to the materials we had that would help research around the body and performance, but to also tell us materials that we should get that would contribute to that research. And we did that, the first guide with Franco in 2004, I think, and now we have about 12 guides, and we commission about two or three a year. So if there are themes, sort of zeitgeist themes or questions that keep coming up in the study room, then we will commission an artist to write a guide around it. And they're all available on our website to read. And they've turned into sort of not just introductions, not just sort of navigations, but also really kind of rich critical texts around certain issues of live art. And we just actually just published another one this week, which is not yet on our website, which is around the ethics of performance, particularly around the ethics of fundraising and performance. The study room started when we brought all of our videotapes from the ICA. We have, and then for the first years of the agency, all of the materials we were getting were all on VHS tapes. And then, thank God, somebody invented the DVD, which sort of changed everything. One, it's much smaller. But also, it just enables a whole different sort of range of material to be sort of contained, and sort of different sort of meta levels. And so now most of the materials we have are on DVD. But we still have these sort of 750 videotapes, and there's some real sort of treasures on there. But they are now sort of on their last legs. It's impossible. Some one more watch and that's it. They're going to be destroyed. So we're now in a process of digitizing of those, and we're doing it manually. Nikki will talk about the National Review of Live Art Archiving Project, and that process of digitization. We do it manually. We sit in the office every morning with a VHS player. We hit play. We transfer that VHS tape onto a little piece of kit we've got, and we have it as a digital file. And we're trying to sort of shift from the old technologies of the 21st century into the new technology of the 20th century, the new technologies of the 21st century. And what we really want to do is ultimately to have all of those materials available to view on our website, much like the European Live Art Archive. Of course, one of those issues that everybody needs to get to grips with is about permissions, but also issues of sort of censorship. We have a lot of sort of work that's, we're interested in a lot of work around sort of identity politics. We have a lot of work from Chinese performance artists. So much of that work is really pretty full on. And in UK, there are laws like the Obscene Publications Act. Most of the stuff, if we have it on our website, we're effectively publishing it, we could probably be prosecuted. Then there's issues of sort of cultural sensitivities and as well as permissions for artists. And I guess it's a sort of, for everybody working in archives, this is a real minefield and stuff that we really need to be able to sort of collectively get our heads around and sort of learn from each other's sort of experiences of how you sort of create universal access. The second thing I want to talk about is a project called Restock, Rethink, Reflect. We've always been interested in questions of documentation, archives, and histories, whilst, as I say, recognizing many of the problems. And we're increasingly involved with the mapping and the marking of performance art, and particularly neglected and misrepresented areas of practice. And as we all know, live art is a practice that operates within and across and at the edges of visual art, theater, dance, digital media, moving image. And it's an interdisciplinary and itinerant and ephemeral area of practice. And so there are many challenges to the contextualization and documentation and the archiving. And these kind of challenges can lead to the exclusion of significant art and archives and artists from wider art histories. And this is particularly the case for non-mainstream artists. So for many socially and culturally marginalized artists, live art has been an incredibly exciting platform and generative site to challenge prevailing and prejudiced attitudes to issues of race, gender, sexuality, class, disability. And it's a space where the disembodied and the disenfranchised can be really visible and really vocal. The contributions of these kind of artists has been critical to the history of live art. But their experiences and their practices are often sort of sidelined, and their contributions are ignored, certainly within the UK's cultural histories. And so there's a real danger, as Brian was saying, about a sort of older art, making sure that the experiences and the work of older artists are sort of documented and sort of written into history before it's too late. It's really the same with a lot of sort of black, women, disabled, queer artists, to make sure that their work is not written out of history. So in 2006, we started this project called Restock, Rethink, Reflect, which is a whole different series of different kinds of initiatives for artists who are looking at issues of identity politics in radical and inventive ways. And we're trying to trace and highlight the impact of art and artists to these kind of debates, but also at the same time trying to support future generations through making sure that they have access to these kind of histories, to making sure that they have access to the resources that artists who've gone there before them didn't have, and to making sure that there's something there for them to sort of work with and an investment in their futures. The first project we did in this was looked at issues of race, and it was included a series of gatherings, artist gatherings in our study room, a workshop led by the artist Janine Anthony, and the publication of this DVD resource called Documenting Live, which is it's a book, and it's a series of artist postcards, and it's a DVD which is trying to reflect the work of UK artists who were working in the 1990s and in the 2000s, sort of different generations of artists, and by looking at work that plays questions of cultural identity and trying to place that within certain kinds of critical and historical contexts. And we worked on the project with the curator David A. Bailey and the artist Rajni Shah, and invited about 13 or 14 artists to be involved in the project to try and create this archival and critical resource that was mapping a certain kind of history. So we invited these artists to one, sort of create these autobiographical postcards, which sort of representative that they wanted to use to represent their practice. But also invited these artists into a series of roundtable discussions with David A. Bailey, so two separate discussions with different generations, looking at sort of key moments, looking at the influences on their practice, looking at the ways that they wanted, the ways that live art had been critical to their work as artists, but also how they were wanting to look at their sort of place within certain kinds of histories. And it was really important to us that Documenting Life was an opportunity for these artists to talk about and to represent their work and their place in its history, and not for sort of art historians or archivists or scholars to do this, because they either sort of don't include the work of black artists in cultural histories, or when they do, they completely misrepresent it, and artists tend to get reduced to their ethnicity, not looked at in terms of their overall practice. The Mexican-American artist Guillermo Gomez-Pena was once asked, "What do you do when a writer or curator wishes to deport you from performance art history?" And Guillermo's response was, "You write yourself back into it on your own terms." And this is what we were trying to do with documenting life. So in that sense, it's an archival project. It's not an archive as such, but it's an archival project. It's trying to write stuff back into history. And if there's time at the end, I'll maybe show you a couple of clips from that. So building on the experience of this first one, and the first project on race, it raised issues that none of us were thought would happen. We're David Bailey, all of the artists, Rajni Shah, ourselves. Everybody was really surprised by what the artists were sort of saying in these roundtable discussions about how issues of race had impacted on their practice, informed their identity of artists, and the huge differences across generations, which is sort of reflective of the sort of history of race relations in the UK itself. This earlier generation of artists like David Medella and Sonia Boyce, who when they were first starting out was sort of desperate to find other black histories. When Sonia Boyce was an art student, the only artist of color that she was taught, that she was referred to, as either Frida Kahlo or African Masks. When she discovered other black artists in the UK, it was like an epiphany for her. So she was desperate to find her identity as a black artist. This new generation, this younger generation of artists, they only refer to themselves as black artists when they're doing funding applications. So issues of race is completely different experience for them. None of us expected this. So it was a real revelation. So we took the experience of this first project, and we're now in the middle of, or coming to the end of, the second Restock, Reflect, Rethink, which is looking at issues of disability and the way that artists are working with sort of live art practices to explore and represent the problematics of disability. And we started this project in 2009. We invited a group of really key artists, about 10 or so artists, to a very small gathering with us to ask them a bunch of questions. In what ways have live art offered you a platform to and a framework and a language? In what ways have live art contributed to discourses around the construction and performance of disability, issues of disability? And what are the moments, the people, or the events that have influenced you as an artist? And from their responses to these questions, we began to develop a whole series of different initiatives, which included a study room guide by Erin Williamson, who's also one of the artists in the Ella project, a number of sort of practical works, creative workshops, and a public program that we presented in March last year, which involved new commissions of work by artists like Naomi Lackmire here, Martin O'Brien, a new performance by Disabled Avant-Garde, which is Erin Williamson, and then a day-long artist-led symposium, which is artists talking, not academics, but artists talking about, again, artists writing themselves into history, artists talking about their work, representing the work. We also put together a bibliothèque of key books and DVDs and a screening program of sort of key works from the last 20 or 30 years. And again, just a way of creating a context, but also introducing all of these sort of materials that exist. And now they exist, now that people know they exist, they can't be deported from history. And so we're now working on the publication, which was generated from that project, which will include transcripts from the symposium, DVDs of the screening program and of the performances, and sort of different pieces of writing that have been written during, before, during, and after the event. And that writing also, again, reflects the different ways that live art can be written about by artists, written about by curators and critics, and written about by scholars. And again, our hope is that this publication will map and mark the impact of radical and inspiring art to the broader sort of cultural scene in the UK, and also, as I say, to function as a resource for artists in the future. And the final thing I want to talk about is a project called Legacy. And again, just going back to this idea that this ephemeral and fleeting experience of live art raises many questions about what it can leave behind, what the archive can be. And this question is a huge issue for the artist, for the archivist, for the art historian, for the scholar, for audiences. And there is also this perception, certainly in the UK, that live art is still the domain of the young. It's where the young kids go to do stuff, and then they grow up and become proper artists. But as this as the amazing European Live Art Archive project shows, there were artists in their 80s who were making performance work, who were still sort of out there making really radical, visceral, challenging, provocative work. And so we wanted to, in some way, try and represent that, mark that, but also in some way invest in that, invest in the elder statesman of live art. And so we set up a project called Legacy, Think It in Residence. It's a collaboration between ourselves and Tate Research. We talk about it as a collaboration with Tate Research, but it's actually something we're trying to influence Tate. We're trying to influence Tate, what goes into Tate's archives, how Tate thinks about what the history is, what the archives of UK, of the UK art scene can be and can represent. So one of the ways to influence that was to bring them in as partners in this project, and one of the ways to bring in Tate as partners on projects is to wave very, very large checks in front of them. And so because this project had quite a lot of money from the Arts Council, Tate were excited about it. If it's got a lot of money, it must be important. And so the idea of Legacy was to try and sort of to recognize the breadth and the influence of live art practice in the UK, but to try and acknowledge its achievers and its achievements over the last four, five, six decades. And the Legacy was try and recognize artists who've created bodies of work and whose bodies of work have really tested the nature and the possibilities of live art and had an impact across the field. And so the idea was to sort of support artists by giving them sort of substantial amounts of money to think about questions of legacy in art historical context and to look at the processes and challenges of how to archive live work by looking at their own work in relation to that, and from this process to generate new works about and around the idea of legacy, as the way that Brian was talking about the collaboration with Modern Art Oxford to try and generate new works which were themselves archival projects. And so we also wanted to try and have a sort of impact, to, as well as trying to influence Tate, we also wanted to have a sort of dialogue with the sort of wider cultural context in the UK by inviting some of the sort of key curators and writers and critics and into this process, by getting them to think about who they thought the most important or the most influential artists have been in the UK for the last few decades. So we invited about 50 museum directors, curators, writers to nominate artists, to nominate up to five artists and to say why they thought those artists were important in terms of sort of performance culture in the UK. And from those nominations, we invited 12 of the most exciting and inspiring artists in the UK to submit proposals about how they would approach the idea of legacy. And so we had these amazing ideas from amazing artists that were in themselves the most extraordinary archival project. And we had the most incredibly difficult decision working with a sort of panel of curators, artists, scholars, of trying to sort of decide, make the decision on which two artists we could give awards to. It was a phenomenally, phenomenally difficult process. But eventually the decisions were made and we gave the awards to Anne Bean, who's part of the Ella Project, and Tim Etchells, who Claire McDonald, who was on the panel, described as two brilliant artists who speak to the present condition and to the history of performance in distinctive and powerful ways. So Anne Bean's project has been to... her legacy project has been looking at her long-term collaborator, Paul Burwell, who was an amazing improvisational and interdisciplinary artist who died in 2007. He was infamous for his exuberant fusions of installation, percussion, and explosive performance, literally explosive performance. And he was a real advocate of and participant in all forms of experimental art, so an artist who was impossible to pin down into any one discipline. And so Anne was really wanting to look at the impact and the influence of Paul as a way of considering ideas of documentation, interdisciplinarity and archives and legacies, and looking at how the hell you archive something like the practice of Paul Burwell. And so to do this, she worked with the artist Richard Wilson and the curator Robin Glasnick and created a project called TAPS, TAPS Improvisations with Paul Burwell. And she invited about 80 or so different artists, Brian Catlin was one of the artists, to respond to this poem that Paul Burwell had written, which was the last published work he did before he died. It was called Adventures in the House of Memory. And so these 80 or so artists all kind of created these sort of short films in response to Paul's writings. And then Anne sort of edited all of these films together into an amazing two-screen performance installation, which was shown at Dilston Grove Gallery in London in 2010, along with live performances by many of the artists and improvisations and installations. And then she'd taken all of these films together and created the TAPS DVD, which is here, which is all of the 80 films. But what she's also done on this DVD is made this amazing sort of imaginary dialogue between herself and Paul. So she's taken all this archival footage of Paul, and she's sort of constructed this this sort of imaginary sort of dialogue with him. And if there's time later, I can leave this behind. People can sort of have a look at those clips. The other artist who's working on Legacy is Tim Etchells, who's a writer and the director of the ensemble Forced Entertainment. So Anne's very much coming from a sort of performance art, visual art sort of world, and Tim's coming from a much more sort of theatrical performance world. And Tim is working on a limited edition publication, which is going to be 100 sort of customized books. And it's going to be called In Time and In Place, and it's about sort of larger questions about time and memory and about the reconstruction of performance as an event which is imagined in the present. So it's a sort of a factional history of Forced Entertainment. He's revisiting various sort of locations in which Forced Entertainment or his own work was sort of generated, and sort of beginning to sort of rewrite that history, and sort of constructing, it's kind of retreading a path from one place to another, and it's kind of writing between performance, memory, the present, the past, and sort of making up, it's a sort of faux archive of image, so he's sort of generating new imaginary images and sitting those beside sort of real images and real memories of his history over the last sort of 30 or so years. So it's a sort of creating a dialogue with the situation and the figure, as he says, of its imagined reader. And each of the books is going to be sort of customized for whoever buys that book. So it's a very sort of individualized archive project. And of course, all of these processes of Tim's project and Anne's project, the things they create, as well as their sort of their records and their memories of the processes creating those things, are things which we're going to deposit in Tate's archive. And so hopefully in 50 years, in 100 years, people will be able to have some sense of what was going on in UK performance at the end of the 20th century. At the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st. Thanks.